Blog Talk Radio.
All right, we back. Sorry about that.
All right, we're back.
It's all good. It's all good.
We still got the momentum,
we keep moving in the motion. Like you said, and what you said, Cam, what you said is a very real statement, because, you know, it's always good to have the family support, but it's also something where you have to have people outside of it who really rock with it. We've seen this so many times, people trying to get out from certain places. You were born and raised in an environment that already has an indelible print in hip-hop history. So the culture there is already set in terms of what the music is, you know, how the hustle works, and how to get it out. Some places, some people have to, you know, work a little bit harder. What was it like for you to see that people were really rocking with it, and how did that give you confidence to keep going forward with it?
It was definitely, in those beginning times, it was definitely something dope, but it also was interesting because you try to remake that, you know what I mean? You want to make the next song do the same thing, and a lot of times as an artist, you have to understand that point in time that you made, you have to make something different and make that a whole different thing. So with understanding that took time, man, because, like, that North Face song was cool, but it was like, you know, as an artist, I wanted to make different types of music too. And everybody might not want you to transition into alternative hip hop. They might not want you to transition into R&B. But me, I always see myself as a recording artist. You know what I mean? So whatever vibe I was feeling, I would like to go with it. And I think that's just a battle with any artist is trying to find their niche in the music industry. Not just in the day, but just in the music industry as a whole. And then realizing that, hey, with music, you kind of got to have an intention behind it, you know what I mean, for people to feel it. And the intention is like, hey, are we making music for 10,000 people in the crowd, or are we making music just to be driving in the car? So those are all the thoughts and things that come behind just time and being a musician and the game soaking up. So, yeah.
And that's important, too, because it always has to be from a perspective of the type of your target audience. You know, we talk about a lot on this show about how artists are making their movement in their hometown, depending where they're from. At the core of it, you always want to make music that you were pleased with without sacrificing your artistic integrity, however, maintaining that tight rope of a walk in terms of finding something that is easily accessible to everybody else. Sometimes music just tends to find everybody. I may ruffle some feathers and unintentionally step on toes with what I'm about to say. A lot of times some artists get stuck where they're at. They will say that, you know, well, you know, and this is where it gets a little bit more dicey, because the fact is, if you don't even have people listen to you where you're at, how do you expect it to get out further? And you're not picking up fans, you know, because when you start expanding further, that's when you start getting in the blogs, when you start getting in the magazine, you know, when your video on YouTube, your audio, all the, you know, starts organically going viral, that's when you know you have really hit a mark. You know, as we stated earlier, you come from a place where it's already it's already been set, so it's a little easier. When you started to see as it was moving and you were doing it and the people responding, how did that start opening up the doors for other venues? Because usually that has to be the validation before the other people will begin to recognize your genius, your talent, your creation. How was that opening up the door for you after people really saw that, you know, after others saw that, you know, your area, you had already locked that down and you were really being able to enable an expansion?
Yeah, no, a lot of it was just networking, most of it, you know what I mean? Being able to have the charisma to have those business conversations to expand your brand. A lot of the music, it's about the music, but it's also about business. your brand. So that's why I ended up getting a record label and having my own LLC and creating my own publishing. All those things in that conversation now lift you up in different areas. Now you can get into venues and have your records get played and get paid for your records. You know what I mean? So, again, like I said, just being around the game, man, and applying it when I see it. You know what I mean? That's what allowed people to hear it and going to different places. Like, I did a show at a college in Hayward. And, you know, getting those fans, and those fans talk and say, hey, he came down, you know, when I was a freshman and did his song, Barbie to the Beach. Those things take on and take legs, and that goes to the next. So now we have another show. They brought two more people. They brought four more people. Four turns into eight. So just looking at it as a number game, too. But all that, man, is just a blessing, you know what I mean, being able to do what I'm doing and seeing it grow exponentially. It's just dope, man, and all of that is really the work that I put in, but it's also in God's hands too, you know?
Shout out to you and Eddie Penthouse as well. You know, we had him on a few months back. You know, he represents the Bay Area as well. Great guy. Enjoyed having him on the show. And he, you know, had a similar anecdotal. What you said, Cam, about networking. Obviously, you're cool as other side of the pillow with a fan, you know, rolling in on a cool summer night, on a brisk summer night. So when you look at that element, how important is it as an individual, people understanding the impact of respect, courtesy, and real genuine vibes pertaining to conversations, not only casual but business as well, to facilitate those relationships and friendships?
Those are kind of the most important things, because even me just realizing it's not just about music, it's about life, you know what I mean? And taking the time to have these conversations and getting to know people and seeing what they do and expanding that and applying it, and you know, they call it collabing. You know, you can go ahead. Collabing with people just brings a whole nother energy to your brand and your project, man. And that's what I learned from just even working at T-Mobile and the different jobs that I had. I worked at Chance, worked at T-Mobile, and just seeing how, okay, when you come together, it makes it a stronger brand. And that's kind of what I brought into the music game too. It's just like, okay, man, if I have a show, Let's make the most out of this opportunity. What can we do? Let's get sponsors. Let's get more artists. What can we do to expand this movement? And I think, like I said, just kind of mentality, really.
Hey, you know what? And also too, when you bringing up collabs, people got to understand that the collabs has got to also be built on business too. Like, a lot of people, just because you see these people collab together, don't mean they friends. Business got to be handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And that's with the splits and everything like that, and even in the studio. Or if you don't always got to be in the same studio, but, you know, all that stuff is a conversation. And if you're not able to open up and talk to people and really make business, it's going to be kind of hard in this era, you know, to really expand you as an artist, what I'm finding. And that's why I just be conscious of that and make sure I just, you know, if people was reaching out and they're good and they want to work, let's work. You know what I mean? We making art, we making music, we making history. So, to me, it's bigger than just that, you know?
Yeah, and that's something of when you get together with somebody, like King said, you know, in terms of the music and everything, collaborations. How important is it for you to have that chemistry with a person that you're working with in terms of understanding how your styles are both going to mesh, you know, for a project?
It can be very important, you know, being able to work with somebody and learn from them too. Because when you're collabing with somebody, if you're not willing to learn from them in that moment, then it's not going to be a good collab. I think both people kind of have to be open and know that, okay, this person's bringing a certain type of swag, this person's bringing a certain type of swag. Now we're meshing them together. So that person, while they're doing their thing, you have to respect what they do and how they do it. And just learn and sit back and vice versa. So I think the more and more I was able to collab, the more and more I understood that. You know what I mean? Understood vibe, understood energy, and understood how to really make a record with somebody. And I'm grateful to be in those sessions and see that happen before I put my foot in and started doing it, you know?
Who are your influences in terms of how you really wanted to structure your rhyme style after? Because there's a ton of them. Richie Rich, Spice One, Shadi, you know, like we said, Drew Dow, you know, I mean, the list goes on. Back and forth.
From the Bay, definitely. I think my biggest influence is, you know, E-40. I work with Mike Denon, who worked on my Ghetto Report Card on a couple songs out of the Bay Area, who worked on E-40's Ghetto Report Card. So that was a dope thing. Too Short, for sure, is definitely an influence. You know what I mean? A lot of people might not know this, but Frontline was a group that I liked.
Yeah,
Those are the homies that I really enjoy. But yeah, man, like, I could get the list goes on and on. You know, those are show my top, you know, growing up and really inspiring to be like them as a kid, you know.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I didn't mean to jump off
Tupac
jump in front of you like that,
too.
But yeah,
let me not.
Yeah, but
Tupac,
because they did the joint with EA Ski back in the day, you know what I'm saying, where he would produce for them.
All that was my joint back then, man. I ain't gonna lie.
Shout out to Uncle EAT, man. One of the legendary producers out there.
One of the best
producers
in the West Coast.
Yes.
Give him his flowers, man. He was doing it. Even the Federation. All that stuff, man.
Yeah,
Federation
Rick Ross.
Going
all those guys. Yeah, Rick Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rick Ross.
When we think about that era, King's 40, I'm 46, we hold such a reverence for what you all have done out there, because it was a part. We came along at a time of Rap City, the Source magazine, Rap Pages, you know, that will come later for Double XL, but there was that time in the 1990s, even into the early 2000s, where there was no segregation of sound in the industry. You know, there were songs that were managing to break. Yeah, they were breaking through on all areas. E-40, as you mentioned, is one of my all-time favorite artists. We had the pleasure to interview his sister Sugar T a couple of years ago, but E-40 is like he is like one of my all-time favorites. And I didn't get hip to him until Sprinkle Me in 1995. But he had already been doing it, was sick with it beforehand. Obviously, what he sprinkled on the Wisdom with Shaw has obviously grown and sprouted a whole nother generation of rhyme hustlers. I mean, Cookie Money, Shout Out to Young Cook, Alphabet Boys, you know, East Oakland doing his thing out there.
Mr. Fab, too.
Yeah, Mr. Fab. I mean, all those guys. I mean, of course, Neff the Pharaoh, Kamaya. Can't forget the Queen of Oakland, Kamaya.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just all of you are children of that legacy that was laid before you. And most importantly, and the thing that is so gratifying, is the reverence and respect that you show for the elders that came before you. How important is that to recognize the ones that laid the way for you to blaze the trail further?
Oh, man, it's super important, because if you don't know where you came from, you can't go nowhere. You'd be stuck. Mm-hmm. That's just how it is, man. You gotta respect, you know, the shoulders and backs you're standing on. I'm standing on some legendary shoulders and some legendary backs, man. You know, being able to have conversations with these people and see them in real time just gives me that inspiration to do more, because they laid the foundation. You know what I mean? And it's a great foundation.
All right. So you're a passport brother, and not the way everybody's going to try to say it. No, this man has a passport, and he went overseas. Tell us about the Africa trip at the festival that you were at.
Man, definitely a cultural experience like none other, something I'll never forget, man. Ghana is definitely a second home. You know, shout out to Mega David, shout out to, you know, Cool Boy and everybody. Man, even making music out there was a blessing, man, and being able to touch that stage with 10,000 people looking at me doing my thing and hearing Hercules and hearing Top Boy, man, it's a dream come true, and it made me really feel alive, you know?
Now, when we look at the Africa wave in terms of Afrobeats, and we look at Tim's, we're looking at Burna Boy, shout out to Usher, who had a phenomenal performance at the Super Bowl. He's got a song, Afrobeats-inspired song. Obviously, Africa is also AISA, all started in Africa in terms of where our history was.
Mm-hmm.
A musical experience, Cam, is one thing. What was it like to just walk among the land where our ancestors were birthed and being at one with the continent, not country, because people got to understand, Africa is a continent with 55 countries on it.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was a blessing, man. A very welcoming, cultural, you know what I mean? Being able to be in the motherland and touch the soil and get the people's energy and vibe, man. They're so loving, you know what I mean, and welcoming. And I would encourage everybody, if you have a chance, to get out there, you know, whether it's Ghana, whether it's Egypt, but just getting to Africa and just getting that culture, you know. It changes your life once you get off the plane, for real. But it was a blessing, man.
Yeah, I know. Shout out to Ghostface Killah, the Wu-Tang Clan. In an interview years ago, he talked about it when, you know, he went to, because I believe if King, you know, King can let me know if I'm right as well, I believe part of Preem Clientele, I believe Ghostface wrote some lyrics over there, you know, for that album, you know, and part of it he had written over there. And he just said, man, he's like, those people over there, he's like, they may not have everything. He's like, but the motherfuckers happy. You know, the niggas is cool because they got all they happy they got each other. He's like, family is big. He's like, they're happy that they got each other. How did that trip come about in terms of how you were selected to perform on that stage? Because 10,000 people is a big deal.
Shout out to Miss Mac Marketing, you know, for hooking, connecting the dots for me and getting me on. And, Megan David, man, it's God's plan, man. You know, the music got there and we're making it happen. Now it's just about building on that, you know what I mean, and getting to the next area. But for sure, Ghana is definitely a second home, man. And they welcome me with open arms. And when I walked through that crowd, man, it was amazing. Like seeing all those people, all that energy at one spot. You know what I mean? Biggest show in Ghana. It's just, you know, it's what we live. As an artist, you dream of doing that. You know what I mean? It's really living a dream. I felt like Michael Jackson.
and one thing about it too, Cam, when you're looking at when you go out there. It's a validation. It is a confirmation of the work you've put in, to where, you know, you are able to go there and play to a crowd like that and taking that momentum back home and really building off of that. What has it been like in terms of getting the outlets in terms of the blogs, magazines? There's a lot of publications out there on the West Coast, you know, One World, you know, One West Magazine, you know, One World. What's it been like in terms of really being able to talk to those people out there?
Again, I look at it as another networking, you know what I mean? It's a part of what we're doing. And just having, you know, a strong PR team, you know what I mean, this Mac Marketing and everything like that, helping me with that stuff and blogs. And I think that's the most important thing as an artist. A lot of artists kind of shy away from speaking and, you know, talking to different blogs and sites and radio stations. But, you know what I mean, it's a way to really connect and network and get your music out, but also meet new people, you know what I mean, and catch those vibes and build your brand that way. So I just encourage, if artists aren't doing that, to connect with the blogs and connect with the people who are on the radio, connect and talk and speak, because, you know, not only are you speaking to your music, but you are speaking for your brand.
You know what's crazy about Ghana is that, you know, all those other countries, they appreciate real authentic music. That's why you can tell the difference between basses. They still want feel good music.
Right, because they feel that intention. That's what I was saying earlier. It's about the intention and the energy you're putting in there. You know what I mean? They feel that, and they put that in their music too. So when they hear it in a different genre or whatever, they gonna attract to that. You know what I mean? I'm a believer in that energy. So that, I just feel like, you know, you're running out of money, man. When I went there and I seen how they operated and how they made music, it was all on their real feelings and actual intentions and intuitions, man. And that was just a dope thing to see, because that's just good, that rubbed off on me and me making music in the future. You know what I'm saying? It's all love.
Yeah, man. And the thing is, the love is the essential element in the game. Now, obviously, you're all about the positive vibes and the peace without the drama.
Mm-hmm.
You come from a city where when the funk goes bad, it can be fatal. How have you been able to avoid conflicts in terms of, and even if there were people you didn't particularly care for, how important was it for you to not bring that to the musical aspect?
Well, basically, you know, my parents and the foundation I came from helped me with that. My dad was born in Oakland, too. My mom was born from South Central LA. So they always scared me the right direction and wanted me to stay out of that situation. But in order to do that,
but we wouldn't shit if that's what it comes to.
You know, they know what's up. But it was about my mentality and just understanding that I can only control what I can control. So, you know what I mean?
Right.
If I control myself and control the environment that I'm in, stay focused, stay on things, like, then I'll be out of trouble. But, you know, it's easy to slip into that if you get into your ego. But, you know, just staying at your ego and staying true to yourself and staying prayed up, man, is, you know, how you make it out of that situation, from my experience.
And that's important as well. We're seeing a generation, you know, of young people getting in the game where, you know, niggas is really, they're not processing it from a perspective of understanding. Number one, this is a business, and this is a branding business, and it is highly important for you to maintain a level of respect and personal and acknowledgement of personal safety. You know, we've seen too many times in recent years some artists out there who have invited the danger and sometimes have paid with their life as the collateral, you know, writing checks that they might have been able to cash. It's just the other side were faster on the trigger.
Right.
Man, yeah, for real. We all hear those stories.
What?
We all hear those stories in half.
Yeah, you know, and that's something that it gives people a
stories.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, them guys, you can tell when them guys negotiate bad deals and they come through in a podcast 20 years later and just air it all out. You don't want to be that guy, man.
Nah. Yeah, nah. But that's standing on business, man, and just understanding, man. Like I said, my parents come from all that, you know what I mean? They wasn't having me even be in any way, shape, or form around that or dealing with that, and I appreciate that, man, just installing that in me and just telling me to move as a king, you know? And that's what I tell the youngsters, man, just move as a king. Move as a king, you know what I mean? It's never worth it. Because you don't want to be that 50-year-old dude talking about what happened, you know what I mean, on these podcasts. You're right. But in order to do that, you got to stay on your stuff. Focus on you. Put your 10,000 hours in your passion. You know what I mean? Not in the streets.
Yeah, and we've seen plenty of the stories out there of the OGs, you know, Lil D, you know, Felix Mitchell, you know, all those guys, you know, who were real, you know. So we know the reputation the town has, but we also know how, you know, how things could go on either side of it in terms of what moves. When you look at the game today of how music is marketed, Cam, how people are going to it on social media, how important is it for you to keep it organic? Obviously, you're not about the foolishness. You're not about the drama. You let the talent speak for itself. What do you have to say about artists who get out there and they just totally act like a fucking, as our Jewish brothers and sisters would say, a total putz?
Man, that is a real good question. I feel like just when I talk to, well, if an artist asks me and wants to know, you know, what I think about what they should do, I first say, tell them, look in the mirror. You know what I mean? How do you feel about what you're doing? You know, can you go on stage and do what you're doing right now in front of 15,000 people and are they going to feel that? If not, then you got to change the direction. It's okay to change. Everybody gets chances, second chances, but just make sure you're learning from your mistakes. You know what I mean? Everybody makes mistakes, but as an artist, you know, make sure you learn from them and evolve from, you know, what you've seen and have an intention behind it. That's the biggest thing is, like, because people are going to feel what you're bringing, putting out. You know what I mean? If you're putting out, you know, whatever vibe you're putting out and you're not feeling it, what makes you think they're going to feel it? You know? But that's what I would tell them.
Typical day in Oakland on the fun side in terms of the skidding, watching the honeys, and just hanging out. What was a typical day like for you coming up, growing up?
Oh, yeah, man. Me, it was basketball. Basketball was everything. You know,
Mosswood? Did you play Mosswood Park?
I played Mosswood. I played in a lot of parks at Richmond, a lot of parks in Silicon Valley. Anywhere they was hooping, I was hooping, you know? So,
gotcha.
Coming up, yeah. It was the main passion until music came into me in my life and really helped me as far as, like, being able to emotionally put things on the canvas, you know? But, yeah, that's, you could find me hooping in the rain, outside, anywhere. You know, Vegas, we would travel a lot too. So you see me going to Vegas, you know, traveling in different cities.
Okay.
In San Diego, yeah. So I was really a hooper.
Look, the bowling pedigree heavy too. Gary Payton, Jason Kidd, like we said, Dame Lillard,
yeah.
Kevin Johnson, you know, all of
them,
you know,
yeah,
come
yeah.
from there.
Yeah.
Man, J.R. Ryder, you know what I'm saying? East Bay Funk.
Ooh, okay. So, yeah, J.R. Ryder is a legend. Boy, that's crazy. Yeah.
So you said traveling to Reno, Vegas. I take it you was heavy in the balling in high school and all that.
Oh, yeah, definitely, man. Hoop was the first passion, man. You know, it was first love. Definitely taught me a lot. And it helped me a lot from what I learned from hoop. To be in the music industry, to be honest with you, it's very similar when it comes to certain things, you know, you're dealing with people and networking and being able to, you know, have a team atmosphere and make music with people as a team and all that stuff is things that I learned at an early age.
When you look at seeing basketball is also a passion of yours, how do you feel about the NBA today, college sports, the NIL? How a lot of these, you know, young brothers and sisters are being able to really, you know, in terms of how the playing sound could evolve and how a lot of young brothers and sisters are able to profit.
Oh, I actually love it. They're able to get their money, whether it's the G League or they're, you know, going to the league. They don't have to just go to college and waste 4 years of their, you know, their prime and stuff like that. I think it's a good thing that the NBA is doing. And as far as the game is being played, it is a little softer, you know what I mean? But it takes a little bit more strategy and a little bit more finesse now, which isn't bad. That's just how the game evolves, you know what I mean? It's going to evolve from here, you know? But I like it, man. Basketball is something that I enjoy playing and watching.
Okay, so you come from the area of the San Francisco Dons. Rest in peace to the great, late great Bill Russell, who played there. Of course, Jason Kidd and Lamar Burry played at Cal Bears.
Yeah.
You know who else? Trying to think of Ed Gray, of course, back in the day as well. You know, Randy Duck. Shucks, man. I mean, you know, Kevin Johnson went to Cal. You know, he was there.
Kevin Johnson,
you know?
Yeah. He was the mayor of Sacramento, too.
Oh, Sacramento, yeah.
My mother actually went to California Berkeley, so I was able to be on that campus and see, you know, the games and stuff like that. So just well-rounded, man. Just grateful to be, you know, able to see the things I've seen when I was a kid.
Of course, can't forget Stanford and Palo Alto. You know, Arthur Lee used to be playing there. You know, the Lopez brothers, Brevin Knight.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it,
yeah, yeah.
it definitely, yeah, man. Who would you want to work with in the game in terms of your music?
I would love to work with Drake, Kanye, you know what I mean? E-40, Snoop. All the greats, man. Like those are people I want to pick their brain, and even Future. You know what I mean? Future too. Just pick their brain and pick up things and musically that can enhance my music too, man. And like those sessions are like gold. You know, being in those studios with those people.
When you think about the how it's evolved, how people are able to do business in the game, how you're able to pick up on that. I mean, when you go into Aquagata, it was huge. Where has been some of the other places that you've been able to travel in terms of doing shows, and what has the reception been like?
Oh, yeah, so I actually have shows coming up. We got places touring in Atlanta. I'm going back to Ghana, Rahway, New Jersey, and New York City. So all those places are coming.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So, and I'll have all that on my website and on my Instagram. If you guys want to tap in with me and see all those cities, they're going to be up. It's on camcrazy.com. So that's KAMKRZY.com. And you'll have all the updates, all the city I've been touring and stuff like that. The last one I did was in Ghana. That was the biggest one. And you know, I'm looking forward to Tokyo and places like that in Paris. So the brand is getting bigger and we're moving, and it's all a blessing, man.
Yeah, man.
So,
now you know everybody's been talking too lately about their top five, starting five in NBA. You know, I believe Iverson had his, Steph Curry had his. King and Cam, who are y'all top five? Who's y'all starting five?
You saying NBA?
Yeah, NBA.
NBA?
Yeah.
Oh. I'll put Steph Curry at the one, Kobe at the two, I'll put Kevin Durant at the three, I'll put Kevin Garnett at the four, and I'll put Shaq at the five.
Okay. King, who would you have?
Let me see. I have Allen Iverson, point guard, shooting guard. You got to have Mike.
Of course.
Small forward. Believe it or not, I might have Magic at small forward. Now, power forward. Y'all gonna laugh at this one. Y'all gonna laugh at this one. I might have Tom Shepard from above the rim. That dude came out there on a trench coat, man, and lit him up 100 points.
Yeah, he wasn't playing. Classic.
Shaq and the Dominic, because you know you ain't getting no rebounds when Shaq in the middle.
No, nobody getting no rebounds.
Tom Shepard, he gonna come out with his coat. He gonna light them all up for at least about 101 quarter.
Yep.
That was an incredible performance.
Man.
Yeah.
So for me, I'll probably. And it's wild. The only double I have is Mike. you know, for my I have him at two. I'll have King already picked. He picked Iverson at one, but he already picked Magic for his small forward, and that's not a stretch because if you look at the 1979 NBA Finals, Magic played all five positions. You know, when Kareem got hurt, he played all five, and that's when he scored the 42 points. You know, that's to put him in the starting role. Yeah. I would probably put Jason Kidd at the one. Unbelievable court.
Ooh, okay.
You know, Kidd was unbelievable in his court vision, and he always got his guys the ball. Mike at the two. I'd have Scott. I have LeBron at the – man. I would put LeBron at the – I have him as my small forward. Tim Duncan is my power forward, and I'd have Prime Olajuwon as my five in the center.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. That'll be a good five.
Ain't gonna be no
3-point
shooting, but it'll be a good five.
Oh yeah. No, I won't. But I tell you one thing though. When you look at the game, like you said, Cam, you know, the NBA, we all grew up in that time watching where the game was just totally, you know, and it's aesthetically it's a lot more for the audience. You know, back in the day of the rough and tumble, especially in the Eastern Conference, diehard Bulls fan over here. And, you know, we had to fight through the Pacers, the Knicks, the Heat, you know, the Celtics, you know, Pistons. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, you had to earn that shit back in the day. So when you won the title, it was really something. You know, and nowadays it's really about, you know, as they say, you know, like they say in the NFL, they don't really play defense. They, you know, if you touch somebody, it's an automatic foul. You know, they want the stars to shine, and I get it. But that was a different league back in the day. From the years of 1980 in earnest when it really started to blow to even the mid-2000s, the NBA was like, you were fighting to get it. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. It changed after the Malice in the Palace. That's when it changed. After the Malice in the Palace, they was like, okay, we're gonna have to tone this down. But you're right, the game is totally different.
Hard to believe this fall to be 20 years since that happened, and I remember that night it did. I was in bed watching the game, I mean, and nigga, I seen that shit unfold like in real. Mm-hmm. My nigga, I seen that shit real unfold in real time. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
No way. I'm like, man, look, they about to take the hood out the NBA for good.
They did. They took it out. They took it out. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like that was the point in the changing point in basketball, just in general. Being played, even when Steph Curry came in and started shooting threes from half court, it changed it a little bit too. But I think for sure the Malice in the Palace is when everything kind of got a little softer.
Yeah, you know,
and they were straight. They were straight taking it to the streets there that night.
And the game is already, and when you watch the game, y'all, it was already like it was already kind of on edge, but we didn't expect to see that happen. You know,
we
seen
Port Arthur and Queensbridge take on Detroit.
Yeah.
Shout out to Steve Jackson and Ron Artest. Man.
Yeah.
Ben
Wallace
in
that.
But, and it's crazy because you look at the Pacers, they were number one in the East at that time. You know, and then, you know, what some say had that not happened, you know, all them dudes ain't get suspended and everything, you know.
They probably would have won it that year.
Yeah, they might have won that year. They had the team.
You saying the Pacers? Wait, did Detroit win that year, though?
Detroit ended up winning that year. That was going in 2005.
Okay,
the Spurs ended up winning that year. No, the Spurs ended up winning that year in 2005. 2004, 2005, the Spurs won it that year.
Okay.
But Detroit was coming off of winning the title. It also showed, when we look at corporate entities of how it was, there's a, and it's kind of translated into this modern day, y'all, because when we look at the NBA, if that was a referendum on what was considered too much of quote-unquote street culture, and the NBA is a corporate entity, so they were trying to protect their brand. Did David Stern rest in
peace? It was really
go a little bit overboard.
Really?
And when David Stern, what the edict that he put out, talking about how they couldn't dress anymore, they couldn't wear the big jewelry, I thought that was a little bit much. I'm like, you know,
yeah,
but
that was the bad part about it. It gave them an excuse to really.
Right.
It really gave them an excuse to really take on and put on certain rules and regulations that they deemed at the time was probably racist, but that gave them a good excuse to do it.
Right. Now they have an excuse. You're right. And now they can control it. That was their way of controlling. Yeah. But a lot of that culture was hip-hop culture. I don't know, bringing that hip-hop culture to the league. You know what I mean? And that's the influence that hip-hop had at the time, too, in that era. So I think it's interesting how it played out.
Yeah.
You know, when we look at Iverson, shout out to him representing my hometown, Hampton Roads, Virginia. When he came in, Iverson brought a level of swag to the league that we had not seen in terms of a dude who openly, you know, wore cornrows, got the tattoos a few years later. A couple years later, that's when he got the tat. And was unapologetic. I mean, the dude even made a rap song that David Stern was like, you may want to rethink this.
Shaq and Kobe did one, I think, too.
Yeah, they did. But when Iverson did his, I mean, but Kobe, you know, shout out to him, rest in peace. You know, he did a track on Brian McKnight, one of his songs, a remix. You know, he did a track on it. Kobe actually had recorded an album called, I believe, Dream.
Oh.
It never got released, though. Yeah, he did release an album. Matter of fact, I got to go through my mag, Cam, but I'm going to shoot you that picture when I find it.
Okay.
On the DM, I'm going to shoot it to you from that ad that they have for Kobe. Visions. That's what it was called. Visions. That's what it was called.
Oh, yeah, shoot it. Shoot it over.
It's going to be called Visions. It was going to be called Visions. And it was going to be released. I think it was on Atlantic or DreamWorks. But either way, he did record an album. Iverson, when he recorded 40 Bars, we love AI out here. But when we're putting our journalistic hip-hop, you know, hats on of the culture, it's not a great song.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not throwing shade when we say it. It just wasn't. It was not a great song. It wasn't.
It wasn't like Dame.
You know, Dame is fucking ridiculous.
Dame. He got bars.
That's actually one of my favorite battles, man, with Shaq and Dame Lillard.
I gotta give
it's actually one of my favorite battles, believe it or not.
Man.
Oh man, yeah, it's entertaining for sure. For sure, entertaining.
I mean,
but yeah, he got it though.
Dame time is stick with it on the pen rhyme. I mean, he is just. Look, that man already got a career mapped out for him when he retires. And he's still going to be young enough to do it when he does.
Yeah, he got it. I ain't lying about that. He got it. Yes, he did.
Yeah.
But that's dope to see, though, you know what I'm saying? Like, seeing them do that in hip-hop and just how hip-hop and basketball is kind of intertwined, you know? You go to these basketball venues, and they playing hip-hop, they having a good time, and it's like ever since N1 and all that type of stuff. I grew up, you know, seeing N1 and doing the N1 games, and man, it's energy there, you know, and it's all coinciding with hip-hop in the culture, so that's why
it's
I
crazy.
Always thought they were intertwined.
Man, it's crazy because y'all saw, you know, we all saw the N1 documentary. In terms of what it was, once again, we're all old enough to and young enough to remember that time. I mean, that was just we say this as the cool uncles at the cookout telling the youngins, y'all just had to have been there to really understand what it was. What was
man,
that?
It was different.
Yeah.
Energy was different.
Yeah.
I think what
and
happens
to be honest,
people,
I don't think there'll never be nothing like it.
Yeah, people are less concerned with their image. So I think that's what plays in with even with modern sports, like even with the All-Star game. I think what happened was they don't want to be made to look bad. Like, they don't want to become a meme or they want to go viral for looking bad. Everybody's protecting their ego. And when you're protecting your ego, you're not really letting yourself have fun, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Because you're concerned about what other people are thinking instead of actually just being yourself.
Yeah, I mean, and when you think about the Rucker during that time, you know, rest in peace Greg Maris, you know, and who was later on one of the ones who really was, like, organized. I mean, when you look at the time of, you know, with all the players that came through, I mean, you know, Jerry Stackhouse played in it. Iverson played in it. Kobe played in it. You know, there was a lot of NBA players, you know, who would come into play. We missed out on one of the greatest games that never happened, Terror Squad versus Rockefeller. That was in 2005 with the infamous New York City blackout. Fat Joe was telling that story about how, you know, they had that all, you know, put together, and then, you know, what happened happened. I mean, Vince Carter played in one for in 1 year. He played in, you know. But that was played. Yeah, he played at the Rucker. It was in a gym 1 year because it was raining outside, so they did it in a high school gym. But I do believe they have footage of Vince playing in it. But that was like King was saying, when we look at music, when we look at sports, when we look at the culture of it in terms of a certain level of exuberance, expression, fashion, attitude, certain things just come in. When we look at the Rucker, we look at the And One circuit that as it progressed in that time, we had never seen, we had only heard the stories about New York ballers, of which there are abundant and many when you look at who came from there. Marbury, Kenny Anderson, so many of them.
Carmelo.
You know, Carmelo's born.
He was Baltimore. He was Baltimore.
Yeah, but he was born in New York. He was born there. Nisha Butler, who actually passed Kenny Anderson at the time as all-time leading scorer in New York history. You know, Nisha Butler was serious with it. Trying to think who else was some of them. Pee Wee Kirkland, you know, the playground ballers, you know, Joe the Destroyer Hammond, you know, Earl the Goat Manigault. The history in Rafer Alston, Rafer Skidamalu Alston.
He was an N1 too.
Who went to Fresno State. He's considered one of the new generations that really facilitated that growth from the video that came out and that was shot in 1994. And Rafer was like 16 at the time, and this nigga's tearing off grown-ass men on the court. I mean, this dude's handles of 16 are just fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, but when you saw
he
how
played in the league
saw
too.
That love. Yes, he did. I believe three teams. I know he played with Toronto. He played with Milwaukee. And he played about 12 years, you know, in the league.
Yeah.
You know, when we see that era, y'all, and to see that level of athleticism, the shimmy, shake, all types of bake, that they was cooking what was on in the court, you know what I mean? It was wild because we had never seen anything like that before, you know. And and when they took it on tour, you know, they came out to Norfolk 1 year back in 2002. Me and a shorty, I was, you know, messing with the time. Me and her went to it at Norfolk State. University, you know, Echoes Hall, you know, Jim, shout out to the Green and Gold, and had a great time. You know, one of my boys I went to high school with, David Selby, he played against them. It was just a vibe, man.
It was just a vibe.
Yeah, definitely.
You had to be outside too, man. Definitely. You had to be outside and mingle with the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, different. It was different, but it was connected at a different level, you know? And I feel like that's the difference in today's NBA and players now, is like that right there, you know? That changed how everybody looks at Vince Carter. That changed how everybody looked at Allen Iverson. That changed Hot Sauce and them actually doing those things, you know?
Nike even made a commercial, the infamous... Nigga, I'm so mad I did. I could not get my hand on it. Because I didn't know, because it was that Nike dropped that commercial back in the summer of 2001. And Foot Action actually, what I think a purchase over like $100 or whatever, they gave you a free videotape of it. I didn't know about it.
Oh. Yeah, I remember that. Foot Action, yeah, I remember that. You're talking about the N1 mixtape video.
No.
I remember that.
It was a Nike Freestyle.
Oh, the Nike one?
Yeah, the Nike one, you know, because that's from the years of 1999 to 2006, probably that's when N1 was at its peak with the playground basketball movement. Nike always was ahead of the curve. And when N1 introduced it, N1 was still a brand that was kind of, it was strictly basketball culture. Hadn't necessarily broken in on fashion, because if you were wearing N1, that was more like that was your baller gear if you were really on the court, but it hadn't broken through from a casual wear type thing. Nike, obviously, had already been branded as fashion and sports. So when they did the Freestyle commercial, you know, they had Jason Williams in it, and the white chocolate, Vince Carter was in it, Rasheed Wallace.
Oh, with the ball, they were dribbling in it. Everybody was dribbling.
They had a mix of playground and NBA stars. And the first time I saw that commercial, I thought to myself, this is fucking genius. Nike wins again.
Yeah, it was hard. It was super hard.
But
I remember that. I'm playing it in my head now.
Yeah, but those video cassettes out there do exist. I know they're worth a grip if you can find them, because they only put out a limited amount. But those cassettes are out there. If you want to just do it economically, and if you got to, you know, if you know computers, how to quote unquote get it, you can go on YouTube. It's right there. But man, that was
right.
But that
was amazing time, man. I mean,
yeah,
just to see it that in real time. People are not gonna know. They're not gonna know what it was like before really being invested in this online web, so to speak, because that's their form of communication and where they get information now.
Right.
They don't know nothing about the. They don't know nothing about. You remember those stat book? The NBA magazine where you had the stat books and you had to collect those upper deck cards.
Yeah.
I want to know which one of my peoples. I'm still looking. I'm like, one of y'all still got a Jordan rookie card, man. Like, I know y'all, that's worth some about $100,000 right now.
Man, that's
Word.
Nigga, do you know how much that LeBron Sports Illustrated issue is worth from 2003 right now?
How much?
That shit's probably, in mint condition, you're probably looking around maybe $5,000 to $6,000.
Easy.
The Chosen One issue, right?
Man.
Yeah, that's when he was in high school.
The Chosen One issue.
Because the two holy grails of those magazines are the Slam magazine when he was 16 and then the Sports Illustrated when he was 18. If you have either one of those, you got a mini fortune on your hands.
Hey, the autograph, check this out, y'all. The autograph one, the autograph Sports Illustrated issue is $12,000.
Yeah.
Man, see, that's crazy, bro. That's crazy.
Boom. You know, Cam and King, it's crazy when we think about that time, because this is before the only social media back in the day, the first social media we all knew was Black Planet. And then, of course, MySpace would come later. Camera technology did not come until around 2005, 2006. You know, so we still haven't had Twitter, Facebook. Well, Facebook had started in 2004, but it was primarily just for college kids. So it really hadn't quite gotten to that. It hadn't blown up in terms of everybody having a Facebook account. That didn't come until about 2 years later when Zuckerberg opened it up for everybody to get on. So we're still – Twitter didn't come until, I believe, around 2009, 2010. IG came, I believe, in 2013. And this is still before we start – this is still before we start having videos of stuff online, this, that, and the other. And I can't even forget YouTube that started in 2006. So
–
social media was something that, whether music or sports, people knew who you were by what you did. Like King said, you were outside. Like, if you had a reputation, nigga, you had a real reputation of doing what you was doing.
Yeah.
You feel me?
Yeah, that's real. That's real.
You know,
because that was the only way people would see you, really, at that time.
Right.
You had to be out. You had to be out. You had to be doing it.
Yeah, you know, so there was a, you know, whether you, if you had a street reputation, then, you know, before you even got in the booth, niggas already knew, you know, niggas like Fat Joe and all of them, they had a real street reputation. You know, they had their little issues with people, but, you know, back in the day, and we were still kind of in that weird time after Big and Pac got killed. You know, so people were still kind of, we were still reeling from it. 2001, you know, this is 4 years after Big got killed, 5 years after Pac got killed, so this is still fresh. And everybody's kind of still thinking about if we get into it, you know, with somebody. Then, of course, 50 and Ja Rule get into it in 2003, but that actually went back to 2000. But even then, you know, they got the fight of the Hit Factory, you know, like 50 even laughs about it to this day. You know, he says, none of, he's like, we've had scuffles, but nobody's been hurt, seriously. He's like, you know, he jokes about the fight they had the Hit Factory because he was like, you know, he's like, wait a minute, I only get a little cut and the lights are off. He's like, well, leave the motherfucking lights on then, nigga. You know,
for real.
but you never really felt like, and even though, well, he did get shot, you know, we don't know if Supreme ordered that or not. You know, it's, we can say this on air because the we know the history between them. The only thing this is said about it is niggas that shot me are dead, and the nigga that had me shot
it's
is
over
in jail.
Now.
You know, you know, there was a time where the music really was supreme, even when Nas and Jay got into it. I'm like, both of y'all niggas got money. Y'all niggas ain't going to shoot nothing.
Like, it's too much to lose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
they're not, they're not messing around with that street stuff.
Yeah,
it's too much to lose. But, yeah, man, we brought the line. We probably about to wrap it up about 5 more minutes, man. Tell people where they can find you and where they can check your music and what you got going forward.
Oh, yeah, man. So you guys can find me again at social media, all platforms, Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff, KM_KRZY. As far as my tour dates and everything that we got going on, you can find on my website, KMKRZY.com. I'm going to be in Atlanta. I'm going to go back. I'm going to be back in Ghana. I'm going to be in Rahway, in New York City soon. So all those dates is going to be all up there, man. So just tap in with your boy.
Man, Cam, this has been such an honor. We appreciate you so much. Thanks again to Angela for hooking us up with this. You're welcome back anytime. We're supporting you all the way. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And keep putting on for the Bay all day in every way.
Oh, yeah, no doubt, man. I appreciate y'all for having me on, man. It's been a good time.
Man, especially with the basketball build, man. Transition into sports talk as well, man, especially depending on the vibe.
Okay. Yeah. No, it was good, bro. The vibes was there, you know what I mean? It was a pleasure. hopefully you guys have me back soon.
Absolutely,
definitely, bro.
Absolutely.
Hey, big shout out to Angela. Big shout out to Angela for making that happen.
Yeah, shout out to Angie.
So yeah, all on right, that note, man, we about to be up out of here. Catch us Sunday. We will be celebrating episode 600. Everybody, pull up, man. It's gonna be a celebration, as Rick James would say.
Absolutely,
get it. Peace.
Peace, all right, y'all. One out.